Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. In her valuable new book, The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together, choreographer Twyla Tharp tells us about working with photographer Richard Avedon, how he created a collaboration between her eye and his camera. Avedon taught her what the poet John Keats called negative capability, a willingness to suspend judgment, to accept uncertainty and the unresolved, and to see reality as another might. Tharp writes, "That's creativity at its most open-hearted." And in the end, she reminds us, all collaborations are love stories. Twyla Tharp has created a magnificent body of work. Since graduating from Barnard in 1963, she's choreographed more than 135 dances, 5 Hollywood movies, directed and choreographed 3 Broadway shows, written 3 books, and received numerous awards, including 1 Tony, 2 Emmy Awards, 19 honorary doctorates, the Vietnam Veterans of America President's Award, the 2004 National Medal of Arts, the Jerome Robbins Prize, and the Kennedy Center Honors. And in addition to choreographing for her own company, she has choreographed for many other companies, including American Ballet Theater, the Paris Opera Ballet, the Royal Ballet, New York City Ballet, and the Martha Graham Dance Company. But that list of accomplishments doesn't tell you as much as the generous details in her book, The Collaborative Habit, Life Lessons for Working Together. Tharp sees collaboration as a daily practice, and the book is rich in examples from her distinguished career. Tonight, Twyla will talk about her experiences as a collaborator with artists such as Jerome Robbins, Mikhail Baryshnikov, Bob Dylan, Milos Forman, and Frank Sinatra. And then she'll include you, the audience, in tonight's collaboration. And we do have microphones set up on either side of the theater, and we ask you to line up so that we can all hear you and use the microphones, and also because we record for podcast. And at the conclusion of the program, Twyla will be signing copies of her book in the lobby, which are on sale tonight, courtesy of our library store. So with no further ado, please welcome Twyla Tharp to the Broad stage. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. Can I get this turned down? Can I have that turned down? Thank you. That allows me to see you better, because you're really why I'm here. But I will, of course, begin by saying just a little about myself. My mother moved our family from the Midwest to San Bernardino some decades ago. She promised the ocean, and we got the desert. But she and my father were from Jay County, Indiana, were the first folk in that county to earn a college degree. And they always valued education greatly, which is why I'm very happy to be here this evening supporting education for folk who want to learn. My mother began in San Bernardino to pursue a most unorthodox progression of education. She drove me from Riverside to Redlands to San Diego to Big Bear to Redlands to Pasadena through Azusa and Cucamonga to study keyboard, percussion, tap dancing, toe dancing, hula hoop, German, elocution, painting, and in case all else should fail, stenography. I am the product of my mother's collaboration. But before I get to that book, I'd like to deal with the one that preceded it called The Creative Habit. In this book, I began with an examination of a great composer, performer, Mozart. Mozart's father was named Leopold. Leopold, of course, is a name very close to my mother's name,
Liesl. Liesl and Leopold have always seemed peas from the same pod to me because they devoted their lives to the education of their children. And in the case of Mozart, I'll leave myself apart here now for a while, the payoff was extreme. People like to think of Mozart's gift as a composer as being God-given. And that would be fair enough to say, as he's one of the very few composers who wrote complete clean scores, never going back to correct, never writing horizontally, always wrote out symphonies vertically, the whole thing, bang. A rare accomplishment. However, God alone did not deliver Mozart. Leopold had a huge hand in it, making certain that the boy, Leopold himself was a violinist of no mean order, also a pedagogue, and saw to it that the boy traveled at a very young age throughout Europe. So by the time he was 10, he'd met all the leading composers in Europe and they'd been exposed to him. He was well set to begin writing symphonically before he was of that age. Children are amazingly flexible. And if you are fortunate enough to be with a child who has an extreme gift and you can recognize it, I believe that it is a privilege to serve that child as a collaborator. In the case of both my mother and Mozart's father, their own careers became secondary to what they desired for their offspring. From these many, many lessons, I learned the value of preparation. Leopold certainly inculcated the idea of work in Mozart to the point that it's been noted that Mozart in his late 20s had practiced and held a quill pen for so many hours that his hands were deformed. He had trouble eating. That led me to think of a title for this book called The Creative Habit. Those words put back to back might seem oxymoronic, in other words, contradictory. That creativity is a thing that's spontaneous, that flies off the walls, that is heaven knows how it works, and habit is something that's disciplined, regular, somewhat dull, perhaps. The fact of the matter is obviously that the two go hand in glove together. We know these words, but putting it into practice is a different thing. Finding the challenge in the mundane repetition is difficult unless you love it. With Mozart, when the kid jumped up on the piano bench, I'm sure he liked nothing better than running his fingers over the keyboard and creating those sounds, and that the work involved in learning to become a composer was play to him. And I like to think that the best work is done in a play mode, but very seriously, very serious play. In this book called The Creative Habit, the chapters begin with, I walk into a white room. This has to do with the fact that many creative, so-called creative people, and here I must digress to say that I consider us all creative people, that everyone has a gift, everyone has an interest, they are all valid, whether it's writing, painting, or business, or sewing, or homemaking. It can be done with rigor, and it can be done with imagination and invention simultaneously. That, to me, is creative. But of those of us who go into empty spaces, whether it's a white page or a white canvas or a white room, to begin working alone, it's a singular kind of undertaking, literally. And there are a number of chapters in this book that address how best, or not best, but how you might have a shot at not going crazy in this white room, some things that might be of use. One is to realize that your talent is your talent. Nobody else has ever had it, nor ever will, and that it is our responsibility to understand our own talents and to utilize them. So in this white room, we need to ask, what do I do really well, And we need to ask, what do I do really badly? Because what I do really well will get me going, and what I do really badly, in a way, will keep me going, because I can always look to alter, improve, use that. When we fall back on our favorite weapons, as fighters say, we're in trouble, because the opponent recognizes those favorite weapons, and you become predictable. That's not good. You want to develop the other course as well. Memory is a big factor when you go into a white room. Sometimes you want to cast aside everything you've ever learned and pretend like you can start from scratch. Good luck. But you pretend. It works for a split second. Mostly, though, you remember how things are done, were done, and you ask yourself, should it be done that way? And then you start to question, to push, to pull, to prod, and you may find, indeed, yeah, that was a good idea, in which case, accept it and move on. Or you may find another way, also very interesting. The next chapter in the book is called Before You Can Think Out of the Box, You Have to Start with a Box. I literally, in every project that I do, fill it up with all kinds of stuff, memorabilia stuff, because I find that things themselves have a very different resonance, suggest a sensory kind of imagination that words do not. The word for that thing is not the same as the thing itself. And often in looking at boxes, there will be new ideas, there will be old ideas, there will be ideas to be rearranged. And I wonder if at this point I might have a helper. Do I have someone in the audience? But do you have a very large bag with a lot of stuff in it? Okay, come along. Thank you. Very good. Pop up here. You need help getting up? All right, good girl. Come on over here. Thank you. Hello there. Tell me your name.
Nancy.
Nancy. Okay, very good. Nancy, will you do me a big favor? Dump it out. Thank you. No, don't take it out. Dump it out. Okay. Thank you. Now, is that it? Thank you. That's really it? You sure? Ah. Okay. Oh, okay. All righty. That's one configuration. How would you say that came to pass? How did that come to be like that in your box? Pretend there's a box around there.
You dumped it out.
That's right. Very good. Chance is how it came to be there. Now, would you make it non-chanceful? Will you arrange it any way you want? Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Very good. Okay. What do we see here?
A form.
A form. What kind of form? A three-dimensional form. This is actually very unusual. Usually people do not get here in their first pass. No. Very good. Very good. What else do we see here? Say what? In what way? Yes. Okay. What I see is a kind of ritual form, which is great. What were you thinking when you put the pennies around your little V there?
Decoration.
Decoration. And what guided your sense of how to put the pennies? In other words, you circled your form. Why? I knew it. She's domestic. She was making a house. She was making a little white picket fence. There are going to be roses on that picket fence, right? Right. Very good. Make another one. Thank you. Okay. Now what do we see? Sorry? I'm sorry? No, sorry, somebody yell at me. What is he saying? Okay, yeah, in a way, yes. Because in a way, it's also, I think, architectural. And it also, I think, is about being contained in the same way that the house had a fence surrounding it. Here you have these boundaries that provide a home base for the coins. Is that true?
I think I was more trying to organize.
And what was your thinking about order here?
The pen and the paper go together.
Okay. All right, very good. Listen, come here, talk to me a minute. So what do you want to do, Nancy?
I do what I want to do.
What is that?
I can't dance.
That's it? Good. And where are you dancing?
In Los Angeles Ballet.
Very good. So you're a ballet dancer. Excellent. Well, that's why you're so logical, so reasonable, and so familial. Very good. All right. Well, Nancy, thank you. Thanks, sweetheart. All right, so my point here is that she had an assortment of things of no particular order, which she arranged several times, and from these arrangements, she made it possible to... Don't lose that penny! Nancy, penny! Don't ever leave pennies behind, Nancy. Thank you. Good. She tells us something about herself, but she also tells us something about us, because as we look at what she made, we have a sense of how we read her. Also, hey, Nancy, do you think you'd ever do that again? Do you think you'd ever sit down and idly arrange a whole bunch of stuff? Do you do that with drawers? Do you?
Yes.
Yes. Good girl. Good girl. Okay, she arranges drawers in the same way. We all do. Dancers do. Dancers seek to create order all the time, as do other artists. But from working with this limited supply of materials, her pennies, her book, her pencil, she, for me in any case, investigated different possibilities. That's what a box is good for. It has certain standard materials in it. You take them out, you look at them, you say, does this work anymore? How does it work? Does it work in conjunction with this item? Or does it make no sense at all? In which case, you put it at the bottom of the box. But you do not throw it out, because it's there for a reason, and you might find sometime down the line that you need it to jog your memory or to create a new idea. I need another volunteer. Can I have a person who is, say, a writer who has what's called writer's block? Do I have such a person out there? Yes. This lady, will you come up to me? Thank you. Come along. No, you don't have to bring your purse. We've done the purse thing. But thank you. Nope. We got one here. Thank you. She's already done it. Thank you very, very much. Tell me your name.
Tota.
Tota. Yeah. Very nice. Tota. Where are you from?
Iceland.
Iceland. All right. Fantastic. Will you do me a big favor? Well, no. The exercise is, will you sit? Are you okay to sit?
Yeah.
Will you sit in profile? Thank you. And will you put the soles of your feet on the ground? Tota. Yes, soles of your feet together. Pull your knees in as close as you can. Tighter, tighter, tighter. Put your head down. Head down, down, all the way down. Down here. Stay there. Good, thank you. All right, now, this is another exercise, and it's called egg. And it is of some use when one is at odds with things and frustrated, and I hope that that will come to pass. That is to say that we'll see that she's unraveling things there, but we have to let the egg cook a bit before we ask questions about it. These little exercises in how we can examine our work patterns, which is really what we're doing, led me to start thinking about another subject matter. Besides working by oneself as an artist, a painter, a writer, whatever, more often, we work with others, and we hope to collaborate, we hope to become creative, we hope to be productive with others. So I said, okay, well, you've had quite a bit of experience actually working with others, because as a choreographer, we are the only artists who require other folk to work. It's possible to do solo concerts. You can do it all yourself. but it's not the same challenge as structured choreography, which requires other people. Writers can work alone only, etc. Choreographers need to have people. So I've had some experience in collaboration and thought that I would work on another book, this one called The Collaborative Habit, having to do with how I approach the problem and the opportunity of working with others. This book, you will note, has a finished finite image. It's a triangle at the point of which is an individual, solitary, alone, up there by themselves. This book has a visualization of collaboration. It used to be called iconography, now it's called visualization. So the intersection of two circles, one black and one white, does not become gray or muddy white, it becomes red, which is to say that in this configuration, which is not closed in the same way as a triangle, this one flows, it develops a whole new entity. And that's the point of collaboration, working between two people. Now, will you come to me, please, Tota? Can we talk a moment? Thank you. This is a wonderful name you have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, did you find in sitting down there that you had any new ideas about why you are having problems with this writing?
No.
No. How did you feel sitting down there?
I thought it was kind of fun to be in a new situation like that.
Uh-huh. Fun, good, and it was new.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And what else did you feel down there?
Well, I felt that was very close to myself, kind of close to what was going on in my brain.
Uh-huh. So it was both fun, new, and private, pulled into yourself.
Yes.
And do you often feel this way when you're writing?
Yeah.
You do. And so what is this problem then that you're having in your writing?
Maybe a form of fear.
A form of fear because it's not fun to write?
Yes, it's fun. It's just whether other people will like it or not.
Uh-huh. But you didn't worry about that sitting in egg, whether other people would like it or not.
No.
No, because egg doesn't define you, but your writing does, right? So a fear of what others might think overcomes having fun or communicating with yourself. Right? We shouldn't let that happen, should we?
No.
What can we do to get rid of it, this fear factor? Have you ever published?
No.
Ah! Do you have anything that you think could be published?
Well, I write screenplays, and yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh. Have you sent them out?
No.
Okay, are you ready for a rather extreme example of collaboration? What have you got on your feet? Okay, that looks safe to me. Okay, are you a very good sport?
I try to be, yeah.
Okay, all right,
I'm
Tota.
I'm not good at sports, but I'm
no,
a good
that's what I'm asking. Okay, we're now going to examine this fear factor in a different way. Okay, I'm going to ask you some very personal questions. All right, come here. Can everybody still hear me?
Thank you.
Nothing to be afraid of. So, Tota, tomorrow will you call me and tell me that you're not afraid?
I will.
Okay. Somebody open this for me. I got it. Thanks. Okay. That's a kind of collaboration. You have to be willing to be foolish, to have fun, to challenge people, to demand that they do really well what they want to do. That's it. You also have to care about them. The key, it seems to me, in collaboration is to respect the people you're working with and to have a common goal. So for that 2 minutes, minute and a half, that we were being physical, I was committed to her goal, to do everything possible to help her see that there is nothing to be afraid of. If one can be as open and ridiculous as that, and people do not laugh really at you, they laugh with you, she should send out her scripts. This is the thing I think that is hard to learn about audiences. Even though we believe it of our parents, they don't want you to fail. They want you to succeed. And if you tap into that sense, yes, everybody is afraid of criticism, but ultimately being desiring to share with people can overcome the fear of criticism. And that's where you want to go to. So this book, The Collaborative Habit, begins its first chapter with an examination of why collaboration is at this particular moment in time a kind of buzzword. Extremely prevalent in politics, in business, in athletics, and perhaps less so in the arts, but still in certain art forms, very, very thought about. And it is definitely realized as having the wherewithal to get people to function well together. There's an example in here of the pilot who brought the plane down after all the ducks in the Hudson, and the reality of that landing was that it was teamwork, not the captain, who saved that ship. And it wasn't only the teamwork of the airplane crew itself, but also the other side, that New Jersey happened, it came down very close to the Jersey ferry system, and those people were trained to save lives out of the water. And that conjunction of teamwork made that possible. It's a great thing when people really work together. That's what the first chapter says. The second is called Collaboration is Second Nature, not First Nature. Perhaps it is that there is something horrific in our genetic construct that forces us to be violent, competitive, greedy, fearful. And it may well be that in learning to protect ourselves and forming tribes, we begin to see that by grouping ourselves together and working in teams, working collaboratively, we can become stronger. I speak in this chapter directly about my own experience I grew up with twin brothers, known as Stan and Stan, lest my parents mistake one for the other. They were identical, and my parents had trouble telling them apart. My mother decided that when I was about 12, I'd had an awful lot of lessons and I should become a teacher, and I should teach them. So I took them into an empty room, and I began to do tap dancing and other things. And I realized that one of the twins did better going to the left and one did better going to the right. Then I realized one liked to jump, one liked to turn. And then I suddenly understood that I was identifying them not by how they looked, but by how they moved. And I think that that is when I realized that maybe I might become a person who looked at bodies moving in space, namely choreography. The twins' identities are something that I always feel, not them specifically, but trying to find the unique identity of each dancer I work with. Not to assign them my bodily movements, but to find theirs. That's always a challenge for me, and it only can come to pass as a two-way street. In this second chapter, I also talk about my very first group of dancers who were all women. I'm not certainly the first choreographer to work only with women. Martha Graham had an all-female group, so did Doris Humphrey, so did Mary Wigmont. Women seem to work well together. There is a willingness to look beyond the individual to the group effort. And in collaboration, it seems to me that there are two components that are really critical. One is respect for the people that you work with, and two is an understanding of a common purpose, that this is what we're here for. Three is the willingness to allow your own ego to be second to what the group needs to get done. Women do this. Men are more difficult. I have come to the point where I can encourage men to work together very well. Yeah, it will always be an effort, and the ego will always be invested. It will always be a psychological effort. But for some bizarre reason, women seem more willing to do this kind of undertaking. That's not to say that there are not ways in which men and women don't work well together. Certainly they do. And in the third chapter, I talk about partnerships. We worked as a female group for 5 years with no men. And then we began to filter them in gradually so that we could absorb whatever difficulties might ensue. And then I had a singular opportunity to make a new ballet for Baryshnikov. It was his first ballet in this country, and he obviously was and is an amazing dancer, an amazing performer. And finding a way to collaborate with someone so different from myself and so different from the way of working primarily with women, and then to find a way to feature and focus on him and what he could do was an extraordinary opportunity. And I do believe that that collaboration, which delivered a piece called Push Comes to Shove. How many people have seen Push? Oh, good. Lots of people. That Push is a good ballet, and that Push will outlive us both, but that it came to pass because we were able to hammer out a way to work together. He spoke no English. I spoke no Russian. He was a classical dancer of the first order. I was metz metza. many problems in my classical technique, but I was a modern dancer of the first order, a very different thing. I was not the performer, certainly, that he was, but I was a choreographer. I came from the Midwest. He came from, you know, Russian classical training, and so forth. Very, very, very different. And yet between us, we had a single goal, and that was, quite frankly, to change dance. That's what we knew we wanted to do. Not a small goal, but then why not go for it? So we tried to do that, and on the first night, I think it was clear that we had made a difference, which was what we wanted to do. Not be better than, but to change. Collaboration makes change possible. Collaboration almost guarantees change. You will never go into a collaboration expecting it to be exactly what it comes out to be. It will always change you and change your expectations. And the more flexible you are, the more fluid you are in this process, the more successful the thing will become. That's the chapter that talks about partnerships. It doesn't talk just about men and women. It talks also about men. I did a movie with Greg Hines and Baryshnikov, and the two of them were brilliant together because, again, extreme respect one for the other. Each knew how terrific the other one was. Nobody wanted to be competitive. Misha certainly was not going to be doing time steps and vice versa with multiple pirouettes, but each of them knew that nobody did what they did better. So my job was to try to find something that they could do together that would still allow them to each be their individual superstar person. The next chapter in this book, the fourth chapter, is called Working with a Remote Collaborator. This is a chapter that came from working on a ballet in Miami with Elvis Costello. Elvis is a wonderful composer, a fantastic lyricist, a man who has been through many, many collaborations and a terrific performer. He's also a very, very busy man. So when he agreed to take on this commission, he perhaps did not factor in all the complications that would ensue, and he missed his first deadline. He also missed his second deadline. At which point, he, being the gentleman that he is, volunteered to say, okay, maybe we should not try to do this and I'll make it good somehow. And I said, no, we can't do that. We really need to push through. Surely we can find a way. And so it became a collaboration by remote communications. He was touring. He was traveling in every time zone on the earth, and he would send back MP3s. They would come at strange hours of the night, so we would never really speak, even over the phone. I have Final Cut Pro, and I would do editing and then send DVDs with the and eventually, yes, it became a ballet. What happened is it became first a ballet in technology, and then was transferred to live people, both in the orchestra and with the dancers. This was an interesting experiment, and the point of it is, yes, we could have quit, but we didn't. I have never pulled out of a collaboration. There certainly have been times when I thought I should, and certainly times when others might have thought I should. However, I don't. Because I consider collaborations to be a tutorial in reality, and that it's going to go one way or another, and I'm curious to see exactly what does that mean now. You can, as I always do, provide yourself in a collaboration with an ironclad prenup so that I could have gotten out of, and Elvis could too. We could either of us have gotten out of that legally, out of that collaboration, but we both felt we had made a commitment and we wanted to honor it. I have never used my contractual right to leave a collaboration, and it's sort of a point of pride or foolishness that I haven't. But I think that ultimately, in going into a collaboration, one always needs to ask the question, I'm sure that this would be uppermost with you, how do you select a collaborator? How do you make it so that you're not going to run into these issues where you might want to run the other way? And I know that it is in a lot of research, not only of your collaborator, but also of yourself. Knowing exactly what you want from your collaborator, knowing exactly what you feel this project should be, knowing how to communicate that information to your collaborator, and then asking the right questions of your collaborator to help your collaborator know, is this the right project for them? Is it something that they should entertain and engage in? And this hopefully delivers enough information and also the beginning of a working process where you can see how you're going to communicate with this person that will allow you to come into these inevitable points where things are going to be difficult and you'll find a way to get through it. That was a big lesson in Miami. The next chapter deals collaborating with institutions. Institutions are obviously status quo driven. They are about maintaining their image and propagating how they define themselves. Artists are about turning that upside down. How then do the two work in tandem? I was very fortunate in having my first ballet commissioned by Robert Joffrey. And Joffrey was an amazing collaborator, unbelievably supportive. He ran interference for me with his board of directors, with his dancers, with designers, with everything I didn't know, which was huge. In fact, when Bob asked me to make a ballet, he said, "What shall you do?" And I said, "Oh, I think I'll do Swan Lake." And he said, "Well, maybe we might start with something a little shorter," which was a very good idea. So Bob became a champion for me. And in working in institutions, collaborating in institutions, you need to have a champion. You need to have somebody who really wants you to change that institution. Not an easy task. Bob was extraordinary in that way. He was always up for taking a reasonable gamble because he knew that the life's blood of his company was change. The next chapter in this book is called Collaborating with a Community, and it's why I'm here tonight. It's that I like to talk with people about what it is that I think I'm doing, and I like to hear from them what it is they think I am doing. I like to have this communication. I think that, again, a contemporary word, transparency, is very important in the arts, often it's felt that the art should speak for itself. That's fine, it should. When a curtain goes up, I'm not right there center stage explaining what it's all about. The work has got to do it. But I also feel that it's beholden on me to communicate with people what it is that is being represented and how it came to pass, something about its subtext, something about its process, which allows an audience to look at it in a different way. Not a better way, just a different way. So that chapter is collaborating with a community. The next to last chapter is called Collaborating with Friends. Now, this is a delicate one. You got to be really careful here because there's a good expression called love is blind. But in working with friends, you can have a very special kind of productivity. If you know someone very, very well, you can save a lot of time and you can take on challenges that you won't do with a stranger. In the case of the three collaborations that I speak about in this chapter with Richard Avedon, Jerome Robbins, and Milos Forman, I worked with them before they were friends. I did over a number of, well, I made a ballet with Jerry. I had 28 or 27 sessions with Dick, which is an enormous number. And I worked on 3 feature films with Milos. So these are collaborations that were long-term and profound. And through that work process, I ended up with 3 very dear friends. So I consider myself extremely fortunate. I also was very careful in working with them, very sensitive to their sensitivities, because a friend is somebody that you know quite well. You know how they can be hurt. You have to be careful. Sometimes in a collaboration, our baser instincts, shall we say, may want to rise. And you must never let that happen. Best with anybody, but certainly not with a friend. The last chapter in the book is called Flight School Before Your Next Collaboration, and it attempts to give some detailed information about how to approach a collaborator and how to approach yourself in a collaboration, the responsibility that you have to the other person to be certain, just for starters, that you are physically up to the challenge, because a collaboration, one would like to think, takes half as much energy. That would not be correct. It takes twice as much energy. So that is item number 1 before you go into a collaboration. Do your exercises every day. So those are all the fun things I have to say, and now I'm really interested about what you have to say. I'm interested about any questions that you might have, or anything that's been prompted here. And I hope that you will just ask anything, almost at all. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's loud.
I love what you said about that benchmark you made with Push Comes to Shove. Totally.
Thank you.
So now, do you see or have you seen anybody on the horizon that might do that for us today?
Well, I'm afraid you're actually talking to the wrong person, because I work, and I don't go out. I even hate going to our shows. I work in a gym first thing in the morning. I still work 2 hours, or I try to get in 2 hours myself every day before the day starts. So I can't be out at night and up in the morning. So I'm still a working body, and I can't really be of any use in terms of what's going on with other folk. I'm doing what I can do to do the best work I can do. Yes?
I loved your collaboration with Billy Joel.
Thank you.
And I just wondered how that came about.
My son, my very best collaborator, my all-time great collaborator, my son, said to me, "Okay, Mom, let's do Broadway." And I said, "Okay, so fine, what?" He says, "Rock and roll." I said, "Okay, who do you want?" He says, "Billy Joel or Paul McCartney." I say, "Oh, okay, I don't know either one of them, but fine." I actually flew to London for a meeting with McCartney, who is very charming, wonderful, and British. Which is why I didn't use the Beatles a long time ago when I did the piece called Discoupe with the Beach Boys. I ultimately selected an American group because, obviously, I understand this country better than I do the Brits. Billy Joel was another matter. I didn't know Billy, but I got some of his music, and I took my touring company into a studio and did a week's work, maybe, video edited the tape, and got Billy's number and just called him up and said, "You don't know me, but I have something I'd like to show you. Would you come look at it?" And he did. And he very much liked what he saw. He said, "Okay, what do you want from me?" And I said, "All your music." He said, "Okay, you got it." I said, "I do." And then he sent me all of his recordings. I listened to it all in chronological order over one weekend, and I saw a narrative thread going through the songs, and it was that simple. And I often feel that the best collaborations are simple. They come together, they happen easily, they happen without a whole lot of And that was certainly the case with Billy. So that's how it came to pass. Do I have another question, sir?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Could you talk about your early work with Trisha Brown? And
I'm sorry, who's talking here? I'm not seeing you. Where are you? Okay, oh, good. Yes, yeah, sorry. Early work?
Early work with Trisha Brown.
I never worked with Trisha Brown. I worked at the Judson Church in 1966. My group of dancers, the girls that I referred to, we rehearsed in the gym. And we did one concert upstairs one evening, which featured a piece called Removes. But I never worked with any of the Judson people. I never was a part of the Grand Union. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Hi. The world appears to be changing rapidly. Do you agree that it is? And if you do agree, how do you incorporate that into your work?
What do you have in mind when you say changing rapidly?
Information coming to us very quickly. New information. More
technology.
People in the world, more PhDs, more news very quickly, that kind of thing.
That is a very broad question. You are asking how does change impact on what I do, I think.
Yes.
I would say, for example, one thing that I think about are spans of concentration. Obviously, with snippets of information, I mean, 15 years ago, people were not looking at edits that are as fast as editing is now. It's becoming almost, multi-frame per second. And knowing that the eye of the viewer is becoming acclimated to that kind of rapidity, that kind of speed, means that you, one, does not sit and spin wheels. You got to keep it moving along. I listen sometimes to, say, Haydn. Take Haydn. There will be repeats in there. Those repeats would not be there today. Those repeats are there because the audience did not have recording devices and couldn't listen to the records at home, so that the composers had to embed the theme of their music before they started on their variations. That would not be the case now. That is obviously something that has changed with, speed of information. Those are two examples I can think of. The internet is a huge challenge. I mean, it's a massive challenge. I don't pretend to have dealt with it. I have been documenting the dancing that I do since 68. I had, 69, I had a video system, barely portable, but never mind. I do have a lot of recorded information, which is very different. I'm the first generation of choreographer who has had access to recording devices almost from the beginning of their career. That is a big change. But the internet itself and how to deal with the worldwide communications that it affords, the worldwide kind of collaboration, actually, that it affords, how to use those that open-walled sense that the internet is not something I have approached at all, and certainly is a real challenge.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
I wonder if you could compare working collaboration in film, where there's a director, like the performer, versus theater and concert dance, where you're basically the boss. I know you're collaborating, but there is nothing to see unless you create it. What's the difference? What was that experience like working with a director?
Yes, her question, for those of you who might not have heard, is what is the difference between working with a director such as Milos in a collaboration as opposed to working in a singular arena like concert dance where there's essentially my vision is what's the controlling interest here. That was a question that concerned me deeply, and I thought a long time before I agreed to do the first movie because I was very, very concerned that I would not be able to work under the condition where I wouldn't be in control, that it would be someone else's idea that I was trying to implement. Could I understand his idea well enough to be of any use, or where my work would make sense? And in order to try to address that question, Milos suggested that I come to the writing sessions, and I worked with him and Weller on the script. And in working on the script, I decided that I felt I could contribute ideas that would make sense. For example, the horses in the park. Okay, we were talking about park scenes, and Mike said, well, so what can dance here? And I said, well, the horses can dance. And they thought, oh, that's a good idea. So, okay, that made sense. Or a scene like the dream sequence with some of the imagery there that I could evolve out of stuff that I knew how to do. Not, by the way, that I taught the horses how to dance. I took what the horses could do and taught the dancers to do what the horses did. That's how that worked. But in any case, Milos is a great director because he has this capacity of working with people for the good of the project. He calls it the baby. He doesn't care whose idea it is. If it's good for the baby, it's good for him. And that makes it possible to work with him. It feels like we are all doing the same thing here. We're all working towards realizing this script. And because I'd helped write it and because I was in on the editing of it also, I felt as though anything that I had to offer was implemented. In concert dance, obviously. I mean, I work with the dancers. I can only do what the dancers can do, but I have a controlling vision, and essentially I have to bear the responsibility for it. That was a shared responsibility. That's a good thing. Okay? Thank you. Yes?
I have so many questions.
Oops. She has so many questions. Okay. Okay, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, yep. As far as strategically, how you work.
Strategic? Like, what do you mean by the word strategy? Okay. I think that what this young lady is asking about strategies, actually, it's a good word, but I think you mean questions. What questions do I have? If I'm not working from a textbook and if I'm not working to make a dance that's defined as being X, Y, and Z because that's what a dance is, I'm curious. What can a dance be? What can it be that it's never been before? What can it be more of that we started to do with something? And sometimes even to take on the harness, if you will, of tradition and say, within this tradition, what can I do? What can I offer here? Those are stratagem, I think. Sorry, you guys, I forgot that we were supposed to be in lines. Forgive me. Yes, sir. Sorry, I can't hear him. Nope. Yell, scream. Okay, good. Thank you.
My question has to do with your previous book.
Yes.
Which, to me, makes the point where your career is as a dancer and a choreography, where you learn your craft, and then you apply your craft during the course of your career and over the span of your life. And it makes the point about first learning your trade, applying your trade over the course of time. And my question is, how do you apply that? And what kind of discipline did you find that works for you for applying this over time? And furthermore, do you think it serves as a metaphor for others in other kinds of work besides dance?
Absolutely. I think that it's how we all want to progress. I mean, we want to have security, but we also want to have innovation. We also want to have adventure. So by taking these points of craft that we understand and attempting to use them, in her sense, with new strategies to ask new questions. We get to have our cake and eat it too. What could be better? That goes for everybody, right? So thank you for that. Appreciate that. Yes, was this on this side of question? No, on this side of question.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Do you have any advice for a kind of collaboration where your main artistic collaborator ongoing is also your life partner?
Collaboration where your main collaborator is also your ongoing life partner. It can work. Rarely. Okay? I wish you the very best of good fortune, because when it does work, it's the best. Because the communication is obvious, it's immediate, it's intimate, hopefully there's no bullshit, there's no lying. And when those components enter the picture, there's disaster. Sometimes I'll have dancers who will be involved in an affair, whatever, and I know that the day will come when I have two very unhappy people. So that is a problem. Actually, writers, certainly some scientists have done this. I have two very dear friends, Marilyn and Irving Levin, who are art historians at the Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies. He's Bernini and she's Piero. They've been married for 50-some-odd years. They're, they're the absolute epitome of their craft. They've been supportive throughout their lives. Challenging the best audience for one another, the most intelligent critic for one another. It's great. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Sorry. Yes, sir.
Okay, this is a little bit of a feedback. About a dozen years ago, I was bowled over by your PBS special, which had In the Upper Room. And I recorded it that day on videotape. And since then, I've played it about 56 times.
Ooh, great.
And counting. I can't believe how all the elements of costume, the spacing on the stage, the entrance and exits of the people, and now I have two questions.
Yes, sir. You can have three.
All right. You have the dancers appear on stage from total darkness to stage by a spotlight. Now, this didn't happen, I presume, in your rehearsals or your choreography. But how did that come about, the collaboration of the lighting to get the people coming in, and then they disappear so marvelously? I'm just mesmerized to this day.
Me too. Me too. Here's how it worked. So, how many people here know who Jennifer Tipton is? All right. How many people here know who Santo Loquasto is? All right. So I was fortunate enough to have them both working on In the Upper Room. And I said, guys, I need them to come in direct, upstage, center, down. I don't want to see how they got there, and I need to see them get out, and I don't want to see them leave. I don't care what you do. And so they came up with a solution between the two of them that is a very old solution, actually. It's a slatted ribbon drop. It's a black velour. The stage is hung in blacks. It's a black velour with ribbons that are wide that you can enter in breakthrough, essentially. The reason you don't see them is because Jenny threw the smoke wall in front of it and then lit downstage of that, so that once the dancers exit the light line, they're going into smoke, and then they pass through black. And between them, that's great collaboration. I didn't care who did what, just make them disappear.
Yes. Okay, I got another question. this videotape that I recorded is wearing out.
I'm so sorry.
I've scotch taped it. I've done everything. And I can't get it on DVD.
That's true.
I mean,
you can't.
Huh?
That's true. You can't.
So my question is...
Yes.
You've answered it that I can't... So all these people are probably turned on to this. Is there going to be a DVD that's coming out with it? It's a masterpiece.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, here's the problem. In making these videotapes, and I have a number of them, of pieces, going back to, I guess the earliest is probably the Fugue I have on 2-inch video, from 69. In each instance, getting the last, you know, whatever at that time was an enormous fortune for us, $5,000, we had to sell the rights. And those rights are held by, in the upper room, by a corporation called Low Flying Pictures. You go try to find Low Flying Pictures today. You know, they've been bankrupt, they were resold, then that company went bankrupt, and so on. And so the ownership issue is unfortunately in abeyance, and the ballet is being held hostage.
Oh.
However... there will come a time when all this will get sorted out. And if you'll give me your card, I'll make sure you get a clean copy, okay?
Swell.
So come and see me after. Because you're a great guy. Anybody who understands In the Upper Room as well as you do should always get to have one. Thank you.
Hi.
I thank you.
Thank you. Sorry.
Have a question over here.
Yeah.
For dancers, how can we audition for your company? I've looked in your webpage and... there's no information about it. I had the opportunity to audition for you before, and it was a pleasure for me.
Thank
Unfortunately,
you.
I got cut right away, but it was just a pleasure auditioning for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, let me just say one thing about auditions. You guys, I'm sure, how many people out here have ever been through or expect to go through the noxious process of auditioning? Yeah, right? Uh-huh. Okay, this I always say to people in my auditions, do not take it personally, okay? The person who's in the front... is either got a very clear idea of exactly what they want, and that's been decided before you come in the door, or they're inept, one or the other, all right? And they let you go. That's it. Go to the next audition. All right, so in terms of us, right now, actually, we are auditioning, and if you were to find yourself in New York City 1 week from, what day is today, Monday? 1 week from tomorrow, you would make the last call for the new full-length Sinatra that's going up in March on Broadway. If you can't make that call... I hope after that piece gets up to set out on some new repertory and so forth. And if you will give me your card, I will be sure you're on our mailing list so you will know whenever a project is coming up and we're holding auditions. But, yes, basically they happen in New York. Now, if you do video and you want to risk sending one off, I do look at them. And, in fact, how many people here might know who Charlie Hodges is? Anybody? One person? Two people. Anybody else? Many more of you will. Hodges is a phenomenal talent, and I was introduced to him by a videotape. He sent me a videotape of himself. I looked at this kid. He said, how can I dance with you? And I instantly called him and said, you come to New York tomorrow? Is how you dance with me from where he was, wherever, Vegas or something, I think. So I do look at video. So if you want to do that or your card.
I tried actually sending your video through the information that's on your webpage, but I
didn't
it was
hear
returned.
Back.
Pardon me?
You didn't hear back?
No.
Then I didn't see it. So if you want to give me your card, I'll make sure that you go on the mailing list. Otherwise, send it again.
Sure. Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Anything else I can do here? Yes.
Yep. I was actually just a little surprised earlier when you said that you didn't weren't able to see much art outside of your work, I guess. And that's something I actually find difficult too, especially with being like a student. But do you not find it important to support your other artists? And also, do you find it problematic that there's such a small portion of the population that sees art? particularly theater and performing art?
Well, I try to do what I'll address those questions backwards, okay? I try to do what I can to make it possible for that audience to expand. One of the reasons that I have worked hard, very hard, to get dance onto Broadway is so that we can expand audiences to a totally different place. One of the reasons I've worked hard to get dance into film is so that we can put another kind of dancing into the public and so forth. One of the reasons I write these books is to try to help people understand what is dance. There's a lot of confusion in our culture as to what is dance good for. I do try to address that question in the work that I do. In terms of going to see more, if I worked less, I could go to see more. Okay? Thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sir.
I was wondering the best way to collaborate with an artist who doesn't study the same art form as you do.
Okay, this is a very good question. The best way to collaborate with an artist who is in a completely different art form than yourself. Do you have something specific in mind?
Well, you were saying that you've collaborated with a lot of different photographers and stuff, and I'm a dancer, so I was wondering how to, I don't know, yeah.
Okay, no, fair enough. Your question is a very, very good one. It's that you're a dancer, and so, I mean, let me just, I won't speak about you, I'll speak about myself. I'm a dancer. What do I know from photography? And here's Richard Avedon, okay? What I try to learn about photography is enough so that I can communicate with him, to know something about, you know, distance and lens, to be curious about what his art form is, enough so that I can talk to him. With a composer, I actually played a number of instruments myself, so I have some familiarity with how music is composed, how it's performed. So I can talk to orchestrators. For example, this new piece, there's a Sinatra, Full Evening of Sinatra, and we are stripping Frank's voice, and the only thing that's recorded is his voice. Everything but Frank's voice is live. And some of the orchestrations, not the classic ones, are being addressed. I'm working now with an orchestrator arranger named Don Sebesky. Does anyone know that name? Yeah, good. Who's a great orchestrator. And because I know something about music, I can talk to him about what I need, and then because I know something about music, I know how good he is, and so I know, shut up and let him do his job. Okay, so that's with music. With scenic designers, painting, color, again, I know something about what I want to see. I know a little something about how to do it. I know enough about designers to know Tipton is really good, that Santo is really good, and again, get out of their way. Express what you need to say, and then trust that you're working with people who know what they're doing and that you can, you know, trust them to do their work. Don't micromanage. Don't even think about it, because then if you start thinking about micromanaging, you'll have Tata problem. You'll become fearful because you know you don't know what they know. You just get far enough where you know that they're really good at what they do and leave them alone. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello. Your opening comments, you mentioned about assessing one's strengths and weaknesses, and the weaknesses are what keep us going. After all the years that you've been creating dance, do your weaknesses still keep you going? One question. The second question is, what do you have for us on the horizon as far as dance is concerned?
Weaknesses keep you going. They certainly do. You have a body that is becoming less strong, shall we say. And in order to maintain it, you got to work more. That's just for starters. That's not really what you're talking about. You're talking about artistic issues and questions and so forth, but I'll stick with that simple physical thing. In terms of what am I doing now, I'm working on this full-length Sinatra, which is my fourth pass at Sinatra.
The first was a duet I did with Baryshnikov at a gala for ABT in the early 70s at the Metropolitan Opera House. It was done twice. I think we thought we were going to get Frank to sing, and we didn't. Then the next time I ventured into the Sinatra repertoire was a piece called Nine Sinatra Songs. How many people have seen Nine? Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Nine Sinatra Songs, which is a suite of partnered dances. And Frank did see that. He came on several occasions. He professed to love it. He said that he'd never seen his dancing before. It made him cry because he really wanted to be a dancer. That's really, really what he wanted to do. He said, Frank, you're a very good dancer. I've seen you dance. You're a very good dancer, but don't quit your day job. That was Nine Sinatra Songs. Then Misha asked for a reduction of Nine Sinatra Songs for himself, which became Sinatra Suite, which was excerpts from three of the duets, plus I re-choreographed one more for my baby, which was a duet, Nine Sinatra Songs, for him as a solo, as a sort of existential loner, 3 o'clock in the morning, the world's upside down, oh, woe is me type thing. And Sinatra saw that and asked that we do that when he received the Kennedy Center honors. That's how he wanted his career represented on stage, which was a huge privilege for us. Now I'm working on a full-length, 35 songs, of Sinatra vocals. We also have a female vocalist because the distaff side is represented, and it's an investigation of four of those original seven couples in Nine Sinatra Songs. There are seven couples, that four of them are revisited here, and the arc of their relationship is examined in much more depth than what was seen originally, and they're interwoven, and we hope you'll all come and see it in March on Broadway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, hi. I'm very curious, hearing all the things that you've done in your life and the 19 degrees or PhDs, I mean, these are amazing accomplishments. I want to know, and I think the audience might also like to know this, is how does Twyla Tharp relax?
Oh,
how
please.
Does Twyla Tharp recreate? How does she vacate? Where does she do? Where does she go to get refueled and energized again?
I work. I love to work. Writing a book for me is a vacation from making a dance. Making a ballet is a vacation from making a piece that I might call a dance. They're not the same. Working on a film is a vacation. Every now and again, a government might ask me to visit. That would be a vacation. Rarely does that happen. I'm fortunate, okay? I don't need relaxation. When I work, I'm playing, as I started out by saying. I'm very, very grateful. I love to do what I do, and I love the idea that it might mean something to other people, and I enjoy working to that end. I wouldn't know what to do with myself on the beach. What's this? So listen, you guys, you've been great. Thank you so much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.